I could hold the other person off while I took care of things. Tamaru thought about this for a moment, his right eyebrow slightly raised. "I'd rather not lose you if I can help it," he said. "I kind of like you. Personally, that is." Amame gave him a little smile. "For a human female, you mean?" Without changing his expression, Tamaru said, "Male, female, human, dog. I don't have that many individuals I'm fond of." "No, of course not," Amame said. "At the same time, my single most important duty is protecting Madame's health and safety. And I'm, what should I say, kind of a pro." "That goes without saying. So let me see what I can do. I can't guarantee anything, but I might be able to find somebody I know who can respond to your request. This is a very delicate business, though. It's not like buying an electric blanket by mail order. It might take a week before I can get back to you."
"That would be fine," Amame said.
Tamaru squinted up at the trees where the cicadas were buzzing. "I hope everything goes well. I'll do whatever I can, within reason."
"Thanks, Tamaru. This next job will probably be my last. I might never see you again."
Tamaru spread his arms, palms up, as if he were standing in a desert waiting for the rain to fall. But he said nothing. He had big, fleshy palms marked with scars. His hands looked more like parts of a giant machine than of a human body. "I don't like goodbyes," Tamaru said. "I didn't even have a chance to say goodbye to my parents."
"Are they dead?"
"I don't know whether they're alive or dead. I was born on Sakhalin Island, the year before the war ended. The south end of Sakhalin was a Japanese territory called Karafuto, but the Soviets occupied it, and my parents were taken prisoner. My father apparently had some kind of job with the harbor facilities. Most of the Japanese civilian prisoners were returned to Japan soon enough, but my parents couldn't go to Japan because they were Koreans who had been sent to Sakhalin as laborers. The Japanese government refused to take them. Once Japan lost the war, Koreans were no longer subjects of the Empire of Japan. It was terrible. The government didn't have a shred of sympathy for them. They could have gone to North Korea if they wanted to, but not to the South, because the Soviet Union at the time didn't recognize the existence of South Korea. My parents came from a fishing village near Pusan and had no desire to go to the North. They had no relatives or friends up there. I was still a baby. They put me in the hands of a couple being repatriated to Japan, and those people took me across the straits to Hokkaido. The food situation in Sakhalin at the time was horrendous, and the Soviet Army's treatment of their prisoners was terrible. My parents had other small children and must have figured it would be hard to bring me up there. They probably figured they would send me over to Hokkaido first and join me later. Or maybe it was just an excuse to get rid of me. I don't know the details. In any case, we were never reunited. They're probably still in Sakhalin to this day, assuming they haven't died yet.
You don't remember them?
Not a thing. I was just a little over a year old when we separated. The couple kept me for a while, and then sent me to a facility for orphans in the mountains near Hakodate, way down near the southern tip of Hokkaido, about as far as you could go from Sakhalin and still be on Hokkaido. They probably couldn't afford to keep me. Some Catholic organization ran the orphanage, which was a very tough place. There were tons of orphans after the war, and not enough food or heat for them all. I had to do all kinds of things to survive.
Tamaru glanced down at the back of his right hand.
So an adoption was arranged for form's sake. I became a Japanese citizen and got a Japanese name, Kenichi Tamaru. All I know about my original name is a surname, Park. And there are as many Koreans named Park
as there are stars in the sky. Sitting side by side with Tamaru, Aomame listened to the cries of the cicadas.
You should get another dog, Aomame said.
Madame says so too. The safe house needs another guard dog at least. But I just don't feel like it yet.
I understand, but you should get one.
Not that I'm in any position to be advising people.
I will, Tamaru said.
We do need a trained guard dog in the end. I'll get in touch with the breeder right away.
Aomame looked at her watch and stood up. There was still some time left until sunset, but already a hint of evening marked the sky, a different blue mixed in with the blue of the afternoon. She could feel some of the lingering effects of the sherry. Could the dowager still be sleeping?
According to Chekhov, Tamaru said, rising from his chair. Once a gun appears in a story, it has to be fired.
Meaning what? Tamaru stood facing Aomame directly. He was only an inch or two taller than she was.
Meaning, don't bring unnecessary props into a story. If a pistol appears, it has to be fired at some point. Chekhov liked to write stories that did away with all useless ornamentation.
Aomame straightened the sleeves of her dress and slung her bag over her shoulder. And that worries you. If a pistol comes on the scene, it's sure to be fired at some point.
In Chekhov's view, yes.
So you're thinking you'd rather not hand me a pistol?
They're dangerous and illegal. And Chekhov is a writer you can trust.
But this is not a story. We're talking about the real world.
Tamaru narrowed his eyes and looked hard at Aomame.
Then, slowly opening his mouth, he said,
Who knows?
Chapter 2 Tengo I don't have a thing except my soul. He set his recording of Janacek's Sinfonietta on the turntable and pressed the autoplay button. Seiji Ozawa conducting the Chicago Symphony. The turntable started to spin at 33 1/3 RPM. The tone arm moved over the edge of the record, and the needle traced the groove. Following the brass introduction, the ornate timpani resounded from the speakers. It was the section that Tengo liked best. While listening to the music, Tengo faced the screen of his word processor and typed in characters. It was a daily habit of his to listen to Janacek's Sinfonietta early in the morning. The piece had retained a special significance for him ever since he performed it as an impromptu high school percussionist. It gave him a sense of personal encouragement and protection, or at least he felt that it did. He sometimes listened to Janacek's Sinfonietta with his older girlfriend. Not bad, she would say, but she liked old jazz records more than classical. The older, the better. It was an odd taste for a woman her age. Her favorite record was a collection of W.C. Handy blues songs performed by the young Louis Armstrong, with Barney Bigard on clarinet and Trummy Young on trombone. She gave Tengo a copy, though less for him than for herself to listen to. After sex, they would often lie in bed listening to the record. She never tired of it. Armstrong's trumpet and singing are absolutely wonderful, of course. But if you ask me, the thing you should concentrate on is Barney Bigard's clarinet, she would say. Yet the actual number of Bigard solos on the record was small, and they tended to be limited to a single chorus. Louis Armstrong was the star of this record, but she obviously loved those few Bigard solos, the way she would quietly hum along with every memorized note. She said she supposed there might be more talented jazz clarinetists than Barney Bigard, but you couldn't find another one who could play with such warmth and delicacy. His best performances always gave rise to a particular mental image. Tengo could not, off the top of his head, name any other jazz clarinetists, but as he listened to this record over and over, he began to appreciate the sheer, unforced beauty of its clarinet performances, their richly nourishing and imaginative qualities. He had to listen closely and repeatedly for this to happen, and he had to have a capable guide. He would have missed the nuances on his own. His girlfriend once said, "Barney Bigard plays beautifully, like a gifted second baseman. His solos are marvelous, but where he really shines is in the backup he gives the other musicians. That is so hard, but he does it like it's nothing at all. Only an attentive listener can fully appreciate his true worth. Whenever the sixth tune on the flip side of the LP, Atlanta Blues, began, she would grab one of Tengo's body parts and praise Bigard's concise, exquisite solo, which was sandwiched between Armstrong's song and his trumpet solo. Listen to that. Amazing. That first long wail, like a little child's cry. What is it? Surprise? Overflowing joy? An appeal for happiness? It turns into a joyful sigh and weaves its way through a beautiful river of sound until it's smoothly absorbed into some perfect, unknowable place. There. Listen. Nobody else can play such thrilling solos. Jimmy Noon, Sidney Bechet, Pee Wee Russell, Benny Goodman. They're all great clarinetists, but none of them can create such perfectly sculptured works of art. How come you know so much about old-time jazz? Tengo once asked. I have lots of past lives that you don't know anything about. Past lives that no one can change in any way, she said, gently massaging Tengo's scrotum with the palm of her hand. When he was finished writing for the morning, Tengo walked to the station and bought a paper at the newsstand. This he carried into a nearby cafe, where he ordered a morning set of buttered toast and a hard-boiled egg. He drank coffee and opened the paper while waiting for his food to come. As Komatsu had predicted, there was an article about Fukaeri on the human interest page. Not very large, the article appeared above an ad for Mitsubishi Automobiles, under the headline, Popular High School Girl Writer Runaway. Fukaeri, pen name of Eriko Fukada, 17, author of the current bestseller Air Chrysalis, has been listed as missing, it was revealed yesterday afternoon. According to her guardian, cultural anthropologist Takayuki Ebisuno, 63, who filed the search request with the Ouma police station, Eriko has failed to return either to her home in Ouma City or to her Tokyo apartment since the night of June 27, and there has been no word from her since then. In response to this newspaper's telephone inquiry, Mr. Ebisuno said that Eriko was in her usual good spirits when he last saw her, that he could think of no reason she would want to go into hiding, that she had never once failed to come home without permission, and that he is worried something might have happened to her. The editor in charge of Air Chrysalis at the publishing company, Yuji Komatsu, said, "The book has been at the top of the bestseller list for 6 straight weeks and has garnered a great deal of attention, but Miss Fukada herself has not wanted to make public appearances. We at the company have been unable to determine whether her current disappearance might have something to do with her attitude toward such matters. While young, Miss Fukada is an author with abundant talent from whom much can be expected in the future. We hope that she reappears in good health as soon as possible. The police investigation is proceeding with several possible leads in view." That was probably about as much as the newspapers could say at this stage, Tengo concluded. If they gave it a more sensational treatment and Fukaeri showed up at home 2 days later as if nothing had happened, the reporter who wrote the article would be embarrassed and the newspaper itself would lose face. The same was true for the police. Both issued brief, neutral statements like weather balloons to see what would happen. The story would turn big once the weekly magazines got a hold of it and the TV news shows turned up the volume. That would not happen for a few more days. Sooner or later, though, things would heat up, that was for certain. A sensation was inevitable. There were probably only 4 people in the world who knew that she had not been abducted, but was lying low somewhere, alone. Fukaeri herself knew it, of course, and Tengo knew it. Professor Ebisuno and his daughter Azami also knew it. No one else knew that the fuss over her disappearance was a hoax meant to attract broad attention. Tengo could not decide whether his knowledge of the truth was something he should be pleased or upset about. Pleased, probably. At least he didn't have to worry about Fukaeri's welfare. She was in a safe place. At the same time, it was also clear that Tengo was complicit in this complicated plot. Professor Ebisuno was using it as a lever in order to pry up an ominous boulder and let the sunlight in. Then he would wait to see what crawled out from under the rock, and Tengo was being forced to stand right next to him. Tengo did not want to know what would crawl out from under the rock. He would prefer not to see it. It was bound to be a huge source of trouble, but he sensed he would have no choice but to look. After he had drunk his coffee and eaten his toast and eggs, Tengo exited the cafe, leaving his rumpled newspaper behind. He went back to his apartment, brushed his teeth, showered, and prepared to leave for school. During the noon break at the cram school, Tengo had a strange visitor. He had just finished his morning class and was reading a few of the day's newspapers in the teacher's lounge when the school director's secretary approached him and said there was someone who wanted to see him. The secretary was a capable woman 1 year older than Tengo, who, in spite of her title, handled virtually all of the school's administrative business. Her facial features were a bit too irregular for her to be considered beautiful, but she had a nice figure and marvelous taste in clothes.
"He says his name is Mr. Ushikawa."
Tengo did not recognize the name. For some reason, a slight frown crossed her face.
"He says he has something important to discuss with you and wants to see you alone, if possible."
"Something important?" Tengo asked, taken aback. No one ever brought him something important to discuss at the cram school.
"The reception room was empty, so I showed him in there. Teachers aren't supposed to use that room without permission, but I figured..."
"Thanks very much," Tengo said, and gave her his best smile. Unimpressed, she hurried off somewhere, the hem of her new Agnes B. summer jacket flapping in the breeze. Ushikawa was a short man, probably in his mid-40s. His trunk had already filled out so that it had lost all sign of a waist, and excess flesh was gathering at his throat. But Tengo could not be sure of his age. Owing to the peculiarity or the uncommonness of his appearance, the clues necessary for guessing his age were difficult to find. He could have been older than that, or he could have been younger, anywhere between, say, 32 and 56. His teeth were crooked, and his spine was strangely curved. The large crown of his head formed an abnormally flat, bald area with lopsided edges. It was reminiscent of a military heliport that had been made by cutting away the peak of a small, strategically important hill. Tengo had seen such a heliport in a Vietnam War documentary. Around the borders of the flat, lopsided area of his head clung thick, black, curly hair that had been allowed to grow too long, hanging down shaggily over the man's ears. 98 people out of 100 would probably be reminded by it of pubic hair. Tengo had no idea what the other two would think. Everything about the man, his face, his body, seemed to have been formed asymmetrically. Tengo noticed this right away. Of course, all people's bodies are asymmetrical to some extent. That in itself was not contrary to the laws of nature. Tengo himself was aware that his own two eyelids had slightly different shapes, and that his left testicle hung slightly lower than the right one. Our bodies are not mass-produced in a factory, according to fixed standards. But in this man's case, the differences between right and left went far beyond the bounds of common sense. This imbalance, obvious to any observer, could not help but annoy those in his presence and cause them the same kind of discomfort they would feel in front of a funhouse mirror. The man's gray suit had countless tiny wrinkles, which made it look like an expanse of earth that had been ground down by a glacier. One flap of his white dress shirt's collar was sticking out, and the knot of his tie was contorted, as if it had twisted itself from the sheer discomfort of having to exist in that place. The suit, the shirt, and the tie were all slightly wrong in size. The pattern on his tie might have been an inept art student's impressionistic rendering of a bowl of tangled, soggy noodles. Each piece of clothing looked like something he had bought at a discount store to fill an immediate need. But the longer Tengo studied them, the sorrier he felt for the clothes themselves, for having to be worn by this man. Tengo paid little attention to his own clothing, but he was strangely concerned about the clothing worn by others. If he had to compile a list of the worst dressers he had met in the past 10 years, this man would be somewhere near the top. It was not just that he had terrible style. He also gave the impression that he was deliberately desecrating the very idea of wearing clothes. When Tengo entered the reception room, the man stood and produced a business card from his card case, handing it to Tengo with a bow. "Toshiharu Ushikawa," it said, in both Japanese characters and Roman script. an ordinary enough first name, but Ushikawa, Bull River. Tengo had never seen that one before. The card further identified the man as full-time director, New Japan Foundation for the Advancement of Scholarship and the Arts, located downtown in Kojimachi, Chiyoda Ward, and gave the foundation's telephone number. Tengo had no idea what kind of organization the New Japan Foundation for the Advancement of Scholarship and the Arts might be, nor what it meant to be a full-time director of anything. The business card, though, was a handsome one, with an embossed logo, not a makeshift item. Tengo studied it for several moments before looking at the man again. He felt sure there could not be many people in the world whose appearance was so out of keeping with the grandiose title, Full-Time Director, New Japan Foundation for the Advancement of Scholarship and the Arts. They sat in easy chairs on opposite sides of a low table and looked at each other. The man gave his sweaty forehead a few vigorous rubs with a handkerchief and returned the pitiful cloth to his jacket pocket. The receptionist brought in two cups of green tea on a tray. Tengo thanked her as she left. Ushikawa said nothing to her, but to Tengo he said, "Please forgive me for interrupting your break and for arriving without having first made an appointment." The words themselves were polite and formal enough, but his tone was strangely colloquial, and Tengo found it almost offensive. "Have you finished lunch? If you like, we could go out and talk over a meal." "I don't eat lunch when I'm working," Tengo said. "I'll have something light after my afternoon class, so don't worry."
"I see. Well then, with your permission, I'll tell you what I have in mind, and we can discuss it here.
This seems like a nice, quiet place where we can talk without interruption."
He surveyed the reception room as though appraising its value. There was nothing special about the room. It had one big oil painting hanging on the wall, a picture of some mountain, more impressive for the weight of its paint than anything else. A vase had an arrangement of flowers resembling dahlias, dull blossoms reminiscent of a slow-witted matron. Tengo wondered why a cram school would keep such a gloomy reception room.
"Let me belatedly introduce myself. As you can see from the card, my name is Ushikawa. My friends call me Ushi, never Ushikawa. Just plain old Ushi, as if I were a bull," Ushikawa said, smiling.
Friends? Tengo wondered, out of pure curiosity, what kind of person would ever want to be this man's friend. On first impression, Ushikawa honestly made Tengo think of some creepy thing that had crawled out of a hole in the earth, a slimy thing of uncertain shape that in fact was not supposed to come out into the light. He might conceivably be one of the things that Professor Ebisuno had lured out from under a rock. Tengo unconsciously wrinkled his brow and placed the business card, which was still in his hand, on the table. Toshiharu Ushikawa. That was this man's name.
"I am sure that you are very busy, Mr. Kawana, so with your permission I will abbreviate any preliminary background and proceed directly to the heart of the matter," Ushikawa said.
Tengo answered with a little nod.
Ushikawa took a sip of tea and launched into the business at hand. "You have probably never heard of the New Japan Foundation for the Advancement of Scholarship and the Arts, Mr. Kawana?"
Tengo nodded.
"We are a relatively new foundation that concentrates on selecting and supporting young people, especially those young people who are not yet widely known, who are engaged in original activity in the fields of scholarship and the arts. In other words, our aim is to nourish the budding youth who will carry the next generation on their shoulders in all fields of Japan's contemporary culture. We contract with specialists to propose candidates for us in each category. We choose 5 artists and scholars each year and provide them with grants. They can do anything they like for 1 year, no strings attached. All we ask is that they submit a simple report at the end of their year.
A mere formality.
Outlining their activities and results to be included in the Foundation's magazine. Nothing more burdensome than that. We have just begun this activity, so the important thing for us is to produce tangible results. We are, in other words, still in the seed-planting stage. In concrete terms, what this means is that we will provide each recipient with an annual stipend of 3 million yen.
"Very generous," Tengo said.
It takes both time and money to build up or discover something important. Of course, time and money are not in themselves a guarantee of great results, but they can't hurt. The total amount of time available is especially limited. The clock is ticking as we speak. Time rushes past. Opportunities are lost right and left. If you have money, you can buy time. You can even buy freedom if you want. Time and freedom. Those are the most important things that people can buy with money.
Hearing this, Tengo almost reflectively glanced at his watch. True, time was ticking past without a let-up.
"Sorry for taking so much of your time," Ushikawa added, obviously interpreting Tengo's gesture as a demonstration of his own argument. "Let me be quick about this. These days, of course, a mere 3 million yen is not going to enable a lavish lifestyle, but it ought to help a young person pay the bills very nicely, which is why our basic purpose, to make it possible for recipients to spend a full year concentrating on their research or creative projects without struggling to support themselves. And if the governing board determines at the end of the year evaluation that the person produced noteworthy results during the period, the possibility remains for the stipend to be extended beyond the single year."
Tengo said nothing, but waited for Ushikawa to continue. "The other day, I took the liberty of listening to you lecture for a full hour here at the cram school, Mr. Kawana. Believe me, I found it very interesting. I am a total outsider when it comes to mathematics, or should I say I've always been terrible at it and absolutely hated math class in school. I just had to hear the word mathematics to start writhing in agony and to run away as far as I could. But your lecture, Mr. Kawana, was utterly enjoyable. Of course, I didn't understand a thing about the logic of calculus, but just listening to you speak about it, I thought, if it's really so interesting, I ought to start studying math. You can be proud of yourself. You have a special talent, a talent for drawing people in, should I say. I had heard that you were a popular teacher, and I could see why." Tengo had no idea when or where Ushikawa could have heard him lecture. He always paid close attention to who was in the room when he was teaching, and though he had not memorized every student's face, he could never have missed anyone as strange-looking as Ushikawa, who would have stood out like a centipede in a sugar bowl. He decided not to pursue the matter, however, which would only have prolonged a conversation that was already too long. "As you must know, Mr. Ushikawa, I'm just an employee here, somebody the cram school hires to teach a few courses," Tengo began, anxious to waste as little time as possible. "I don't do any original research in mathematics. I just take knowledge that is already out there and explain it to students as simply and entertainingly as I can. All I'm doing is teaching them more effective methods for solving problems on college placement tests. I may have a certain talent for that, but I gave up the idea of being a professional researcher in the field a long time ago. For one thing, I couldn't afford to stay in school any longer, and I never thought I had the aptitude or the ability to make a name for myself in the academic world. In that sense, I'm just not the kind of person you're looking for." Ushikawa hurriedly raised his hand. "No, that's not what I'm getting at all. I'm sorry, I might have made this more complicated than it has to be. It's true that your math lectures are interesting and unique and original, but I didn't come here today about that. What we have our eye on, Mr. Kawana, is your activity as a novelist." Tengo was so unprepared for this that he was momentarily at a loss for words. "My activity as a novelist?" "Exactly." "I don't understand. It's true I've been writing fiction for several years, but nothing of mine has ever been published. You can't call someone like that a novelist. How could I have possibly attracted your attention?" At Tengo's reaction, Ushikawa smiled in great delight, revealing a mouthful of horribly crooked teeth. Like seaside pilings that had been hit by huge waves, they pointed off in all directions and were befouled in a great many ways. They were surely beyond help from orthodontia, but someone should at least teach him how to brush his teeth properly, Tengo thought. "That's what makes our foundation unique," Ushikawa said proudly. "The researchers we contract with take note of things that other people have yet to notice. That is one of our goals. As you say, none of your work has been properly published, and we are quite aware of that. But we also know that,
Under a pen name, you have entered various literary magazines' new writers' competitions almost every year. You have not won yet, unfortunately, but a few times your work made it through to the last stage of the screening process so that, quite naturally, a not inconsiderable number of people got to read them, and several of those people took note of your talent. Our researcher has concluded that you are certain to win a new writer's award in the near future and make your debut as a writer. Investing in futures would be a rather crude way to put it, but as I said before, our aim is to nourish the budding youth who will carry the next generation on their shoulders. Tengo picked up his cup and took a drink of his tea, which by now was somewhat cool. So what you're saying is that I'm a candidate for a grant as a fledgling novelist, is that it? That is it exactly, except that you're not so much a candidate as a finalist. If you say that you are willing to accept the grant, then I am authorized to finalize the arrangements. If you will be so good as to sign the necessary documents, the 3 million yen will be transferred electronically into your bank account immediately. You will be able to take 6 months or a year's leave from this cram school and devote all your energies to writing. We have heard that you are presently writing a long novel. This would be a perfect opportunity, don't you think? How do you know I'm writing a long novel? Tengo asked with a frown. Ushikawa gave him another toothy grin, but upon closer inspection, Tengo realized that his eyes were not smiling at all. The glow from them was icy cold. Our researchers are eager and capable. They choose a number of candidates and examine them from every angle. Probably a few people around you know that you are writing a novel. Word gets out. Komatsu knew he was writing a novel, and so did his older girlfriend. Was there anyone else? Probably not. I'd like to ask a few things about your foundation, Tengo said. Please do. Ask anything at all. Where does it get the money it needs to operate? From a certain individual, or you might say from an organization of his. Realistically speaking, just between us, it also serves as one of his many tax write-offs. Of course, quite aside from that, this individual has a deep interest in scholarship and the arts, and he wants to support members of the younger generation. I can't go into any more detail here. The person wishes to remain anonymous, and that includes his organization as well. All day-to-day operations are entrusted to the Foundation's committee, of which yours truly is, for now, a member. Tengo thought about this for a moment, but there really wasn't that much to think about. All he did was put the things that Ushikawa had told him in order. "Would you mind very much if I smoked?" Ushikawa asked. "Not at all," Tengo said, pushing a heavy glass ashtray in his direction. Ushikawa took a box of 7-star cigarettes from his breast pocket, put a cigarette in his mouth, and lit it with a gold lighter. The lighter was slim and expensive-looking. "So what do you say, Mr. Kawana?" Ushikawa asked. "Will you do us the honor of accepting our grant? Speaking for myself, quite honestly, after hearing that delightful lecture, I am very much looking forward to seeing what kind of world you go on to create in your literature." "I am very grateful to you for bringing me this offer," Tengo said. "It's far more than I deserve, but I'm afraid I can't accept it." Smoke rose from the cigarette between Ushikawa's fingers. He looked at Tengo with his eyes narrowed. "By which you mean... First of all, I don't like the idea of taking money from people I hardly know. Secondly, as things stand now, I don't really need the money. I've managed well enough so far by teaching 3 days a week at the cram school and using the other days to concentrate on my writing. I'm not ready to change that lifestyle. Thirdly, Mr. Ushikawa, I personally don't want to have anything to do with you. Fourthly, no matter how you look at it, there's something fishy about this grant. It just sounds too good to be true. There's something going on behind the scenes. I certainly don't have the best intuition in the world, but I can tell that much from the smell." Tengo, of course, said none of this. "I see," Ushikawa said, filling his lungs with cigarette smoke and exhaling with a look of deep satisfaction. "I see. I think, in my own way, I understand your view of the matter. What you say is quite logical, but really, Mr. Kawana, there is no need for you to give me your answer right now. Why don't you go home and take a good 2 or 3 days to think it over? Take more time to reach your conclusion. We're not in any hurry. It's not a bad offer.
Tengo gave his head a decisive shake.
Thank you. That's very kind. But it will save us both a lot of time and trouble if we reach a final decision today. I'm honored to have been nominated for a grant, and I'm sorry to have put you to the trouble of making a special trip here. But I'm afraid I will have to decline. This is my final conclusion, and there is no possibility that I would reconsider. Ushikawa nodded a few times and regretfully used the ashtray to crush out the cigarette, from which he had taken only 2 puffs.
"That's fine, Mr. Kawana. I see where you are coming from, and I want to respect your wishes. I am sorry for having taken up your time. It's unfortunate, but I will have to resign myself to it. I will be going now."
But Ushikawa showed no sign of standing up. He simply treated the back of his head to a thorough scratching and looked at Tengo with narrowed eyes.
"However, Mr. Kawana, you yourself may not be aware of it, but people are expecting great things from you as a writer. You have talent. Mathematics and literature probably have no direct connection. But listening to you lecture on mathematics is like listening to someone tell a story. This is not something that an ordinary person can do. You have something special that needs to be told. This is clear even to the likes of me. So be sure to take care of yourself.
Forgive me if I'm being over-solicitous, but trees, try not to become embroiled in
matters and make up your mind to walk straight down your own path in life.
Extraneous matters? Tengo asked.
For example, you seem to have, how should I put it, some sort of connection with Miss Eriko Fukada, the author of Air Chrysalis, or at least you have met her a few times, am I correct? By coincidence, I just happen to have read in today's paper that she has apparently disappeared. The media will have a field day with this delicious item, I'm sure.
Assuming I have met Eriko Fukada, is that supposed to mean something?
Again, Ushikawa raised his hand to stop Tengo. It was a small hand, but the fingers were short and stubby.
Now, please don't get worked up over this. I don't mean any harm. All I am trying to say is that selling off one's talents and time in dribs and drabs to make ends meet never produces good results. It may sound presumptuous of me to say this, but your talent is a genuine diamond in the rough, and I don't want to see it wasted and ruined on pointless things. If the relationship between you and Miss Fukada becomes public knowledge, Mr. Kawana, someone is bound to seek you out at home. They'll start stalking you, and they'll turn up all kinds of half-truths. They're a persistent bunch.
Tengo stared at Ushikawa, saying nothing. Ushikawa narrowed his eyes and started scratching one of his big earlobes. The ears themselves were small, but Ushikawa's earlobes were strangely big. Ushikawa's physical oddities were an unending source of fascination.
"Now don't get the wrong idea. My lips are sealed," Ushikawa said, gesturing as if zipping his mouth closed. "I promise you that. I may not look it, but I know how to keep a secret. People say I must have been a clam in a previous life. I'll keep this matter locked up inside as a sign of my personal regard for you. No one else will know."
Finally, he stood up and made several attempts to smooth out the tiny wrinkles in his suit, but succeeded only in making them more obvious.
"If you should change your mind about the grant, please call the number on my card whenever you feel like it. There is still plenty of time. If this year is no good for you, well, there's always next year."
With raised index fingers, Ushikawa mimed the earth revolving around the sun.
"We are in no hurry. At least I succeeded in meeting you and having this little talk with you, and I believe that you have gotten our message."
After one more smile, all but flaunting his ruined dentition, Ushikawa turned and left the reception room. Tengo used the time until his next class to think through Ushikawa's remarks in his head. The man seemed to know that Tengo had participated in the rewrite of Air Chrysalis. There were hints of it everywhere in his speech. "All I'm trying to say is that selling off one's talents and time in dribs and drabs to make ends meet never produces good results," Ushikawa had said pointedly. "We know." Surely that was the message. "I succeeded in meeting you and having this little talk with you,
and I believe that you have gotten our message. Could they have dispatched Ushikawa to see Tengo and offer him the 3 million yen grant for no other purpose than to deliver this message? No, it didn't make sense. There was no need for them to devise such an elaborate plot. They already knew where he was weakest. If they had wanted to threaten Tengo, all they had to do was bring out the facts. Or were they trying to buy him off with the grant? It was all too dramatic. And who were they, after all? Was the New Japan Foundation for the Advancement of Scholarship and the Arts connected with Sakigake? Did it even exist? Tengo went to see the secretary, carrying Ushikawa's business card. "I need to ask you to do me another favor," he said. "What would that be?" she asked, remaining seated at her desk and looking up at Tengo. "I'd like you to call this number and ask if they're the New Japan Foundation for the Advancement of Scholarship and the Arts. Also, ask whether this director, Mr. Ushikawa, is in. They'll probably say he's not there, so ask when he's due back in the office. If they ask your name, just make something up. I'd do it myself, except it might be a problem if they recognize my voice." The secretary dialed the number, and a standard back-and-forth ensued, a concise exchange between two professionals. When it ended, the secretary reported to Tengo. "The New Japan Foundation for the Advancement of Scholarship and the Arts does exist," a woman answered, probably in her early 20s, a normal receptionist. "Mr. Ushikawa actually works there. He's supposed to be back around 3:30. She didn't ask my name, which I certainly would have done." "Of course," Tengo said. "Anyhow, thanks." "You're welcome," she said, handing Ushikawa's card back to Tengo. "Is this Mr. Ushikawa the person who came to see you?" "That's him." "I barely looked at him, but he seemed kind of creepy." Tengo put the card into his wallet. "I suspect that impression wouldn't change even if you had more time to look at him," he said. "I always tell myself not to judge people by their appearance. I've been wrong in the past and had some serious regrets. But the minute I saw this man, I got the feeling he couldn't be trusted. I still feel that way." "You're not alone," Tengo said. "I'm not alone," she echoed, as if to confirm the grammatical accuracy of Tengo's sentence. "That's a beautiful jacket you're wearing," Tengo said, meaning it quite honestly. He wasn't just flattering her. After Ushikawa's crumpled heap of a suit, her stylishly cut linen jacket looked like a lovely piece of fabric that had descended from heaven on a windless afternoon. "Thank you," she said. "But just because somebody answered the phone, it doesn't necessarily mean that the New Japan Foundation for the Advancement of Scholarship and the Arts actually exists." "That's true. It could be an elaborate ruse. You just have to put in a phone line and hire somebody to answer it, like in The Sting. But why would they go to all that trouble?" "Forgive me, Tengo, but you don't look like somebody who'd have enough money to squeeze out of you."
"I don't have a thing," Tengo said, "except my soul."
"Sounds like a job for Mephistopheles," she said.
"Maybe I should walk over to this address and see if there's really an office there."
"Tell me what you find out," she said, inspecting her manicure with narrowed eyes.
The New Japan Foundation for the Advancement of Scholarship and the Arts actually existed. After class, Tengo took the subway to Yotsuya and walked to Kojimachi. At the address on Ushikawa's card, he found a 4-story building with a metal nameplate by the front entrance: New Japan Foundation for the Advancement of Scholarship and the Arts. The office was on the 3rd floor. Also on that floor were Mikimoto Music Publishers and Koda Accountants. Judging from the scale of the building, none of them could be very big offices. None appeared to be flourishing either, though their true condition was impossible to judge from outside. Tengo considered taking the elevator to the 3rd floor. He wanted to see what kind of office it was, or at least what its door looked like. But things could prove awkward if he ran into Ushikawa in the hallway. Tengo took another subway home and called Komatsu's office. For a change, Komatsu was in, and he came to the phone right away. "I can't talk now," Komatsu said, speaking more quickly than usual, his tone of voice somewhat higher than normal. "Sorry, but I don't think I can talk about anything here right now."
"This is very important," Tengo said. "A very strange guy came to see me at school today. He seemed to know something about my connection with Air Chrysalis."
Komatsu went silent for a few seconds at his end. "I think I can call you in 20 minutes. Are you at home?"
Tengo said that he was. Komatsu hung up.
While he waited for Komatsu to call, Tengo sharpened 2 kitchen knives on a whetstone, boiled water, and poured himself some tea. The phone rang exactly 20 minutes later, which was again unusual for Komatsu. This time Komatsu sounded far calmer than he had before. He seemed to be phoning from a quieter place. Tengo gave him a condensed account of what Ushikawa had said in the reception room.
"The New Japan Foundation for the Advancement of Scholarship and the Arts. Never heard of it. And that 3 million yen grant for you is hard to figure, too. I agree, of course, that you have a great future as a writer, but you still haven't published anything. It's kind of incredible. They've got some ulterior motive. That's what I thought. Give me a little time. I'll find out what I can about this New Japan Foundation for the Advancement of Scholarship and the Arts. I'll get in touch with you if I learn anything. But this Ushikawa guy knows you're connected with Fukairi, huh?
Looks that way. That's a bit of a problem. Something's starting to happen, Tengo said. It's fine that Professor Ebisuno managed to pry up his rock, but some kind of monster seems to have crawled out from underneath.
Komatsu sighed into the phone.
It's coming after me, too. The weekly magazines are going crazy, and the TV guys are poking around. This morning, the cops came to the office to question me. They've already latched onto the connection between Fukairi and Sakigake, and, of course, the disappearance of her parents. The media will start blowing up that angle soon.
What's Professor Ebisuno doing?
Nobody's been able to get in touch with him for a while. Phone calls don't go through, and he doesn't get in touch with anybody. He may be having a tough time, too. Or he could be working on another secret plan.
Oh, by the way, to change the subject a bit, have you told anybody that I'm writing a long novel? Tengo asked Komatsu.
Nope, nobody, Komatsu responded immediately.
Why would I tell anyone about that?
That's okay, then. Just asking.
Komatsu fell silent for a moment, and then he said,
It's kind of late for me to be saying this, but we might have gotten ourselves into nasty territory.
Whatever we've gotten ourselves into, there's no backing out now, that's for sure.
And if we can't back out, all we can do is keep going forward, even if you're right about that monster.
Better fasten your seatbelt, Tengo said.
You said it, Komatsu said, and hung up.
It had been a long day. Tengo sat at the kitchen table, drinking his cold tea and thinking about Fukairi. What could she be doing all day, locked up alone in her hiding place? Of course, no one ever knew what Fukairi was doing. In her recorded message, Fukairi had said that the little people's wisdom and power might cause harm to the professor and to Tengo.
Better be careful in the forest.
Tengo found himself looking at his surroundings.
True, the forest was their world.
Chapter 3. Aomame. You can't choose how you're born, but you can choose how you die. One night, near the end of July, the thick clouds that had long covered the sky finally cleared, revealing 2 moons. Aomame stood on her apartment's small balcony looking at the sky. She wanted to call someone right away and say, "Can you do me a favor? Stick your head out the window and look at the sky. Okay, how many moons do you see up there? Where I am, I can see 2 very clearly. How about where you are?" But she had no one to whom she could make such a call. Ayumi was one possibility, but Aomame preferred not to further deepen their personal relationship. She was a policewoman, after all. Aomame would more than likely be killing another man before long, after which she would change her face, change her name, move to a different area, and disappear. Obviously, she wouldn't be able to see or contact Ayumi anymore. Once you let yourself grow close to someone, cutting the ties could be painful. She went back inside, closed the balcony door, and turned on the air conditioner. Then she drew the curtains to place a barrier between herself and the moons.
The two moons in the sky were disturbing to her. They subtly disrupted the balance of the Earth's gravity, and they seemed to be affecting her physically as well. Her period was not due for a while, but her body felt strangely listless and heavy. Her skin was dry and her pulse abnormal. She told herself not to think about the moons anymore, even if they were something that she ought to think about. To combat the listlessness, Almame lay on the carpet to stretch her muscles, systematically engaging one muscle after another that she had little chance to use on a daily basis, and stretching it as far as it would go. Each muscle responded with wordless screams, and her sweat rained down on the floor. She had devised this stretching program herself and modified it each day, making it increasingly radical and effective. It was strictly for her own use. She could not have introduced it into her sports club classes. Ordinary people could never bear that much pain. Most of her fellow instructors screamed for mercy when she tried it on them. While going through her program, she played a recording of Janáček's Sinfonietta, conducted by George Sell. The music took 25 minutes to play, which was the right amount of time to effectively torture every muscle in her body, neither too short nor too long. By the time the music ended, the turntable stopped, and the automatic tone arm returned to its rest. Both her mind and body felt like rags that had been thoroughly wrung out. By now, Almame had memorized every note of Sinfonietta. Listening to the music while stretching her body close to its limits, she was able to attain a mysterious calm. She was simultaneously the torturer and the tortured, the forcer and the forced. This sense of inner-directed self-sufficiency was what she wanted most of all. It gave her deep solace. Janáček's Sinfonietta was effective background music for that purpose. Just before 10 o'clock that night, the phone rang. Lifting the receiver, she heard Tamaru's voice. "Any plans for tomorrow?" "I get out of work at 6:30. "Think you can stop by after that?" "I'm sure I can," Almame said. "Good," Tamaru said. She could hear his ballpoint pen writing on his calendar. "Have you found a new dog yet?" Almame asked.
"Dog?"
"Uh-huh. Another female German shepherd. I still don't know everything about her disposition, but she's been trained in the basics, and she seems to obey commands. She arrived about 10 days ago and is pretty well settled in. The women are relieved to have a dog again." "That's good. This one's satisfied with ordinary dog food. Less bother. Ordinary German shepherds don't eat spinach." That was one strange dog. "And depending on the season, spinach can be expensive," Tamaru complained nostalgically. After a few seconds' pause, he added, "It's a nice night for moon viewing." Almame frowned slightly into the phone. "Where did that come from all of a sudden? Even I am not unaware of natural beauty, I'll have you know."
"No, of course not," Almame said.
"But you're not the type to discuss poetic subjects on the phone without some particular reason, either," she thought. After another short silence at his end, Tamaru said,
"You're the one who brought up moon viewing the last time we talked on the phone, remember? I've been thinking about it ever since, especially when I looked up at the sky a little while ago and it was so clear. Not a cloud anywhere."
Almame was on the verge of asking him how many moons he had seen in that clear sky, but she stopped herself. It was too fraught with danger. Tamaru had told her about his life last time, about having been raised as an orphan who never knew his parents' faces, about his nationality. He had never spoken at such length before, but he was not a man given to talking about himself in any case. He had taken a personal liking to Almame and had more or less opened himself up to her. But ultimately, he was a professional, trained to take the shortest route to see his mission through. There was no point in saying too much to him. I think I can get there around 7 o'clock tomorrow night after work, she said.
Fine, Tamaru said. You'll probably be hungry. The cook is off tomorrow, so we can't serve you anything decent. But if a sandwich or something is all right with you, I can do the preparations.
Thanks, Almama said.
You'll be needing your driver's license, your passport, and your health insurance card. We'd like you to bring those tomorrow. Plus, we'd like a copy of your apartment key. Can you have all those ready for us?
Yes, I think so.
And one more thing. I'd like to see you alone about that business from before. So keep some time open for me after you're through with Madame.
Business from before?
Tamaru fell silent for a moment. His silence had all the weight of a sandbag. I believe there was something you wanted to get a hold of. Have you forgotten?
No, of course I remember, Almama hurried to say. In a corner of her mind, she had still been thinking about the moons.
Tomorrow at 7, then,
Tamaru said, and hung up.
The number of moons had not changed the following night. When she took a quick shower after work and left the club, 2 pale-colored moons had already appeared side by side in the still bright sky. Almama stood on the pedestrian footbridge, spanning Gai and Nishidori Avenue, leaning against the handrail and gazing at the 2 moons for a time. No one else made a point of looking at the moons like this. The people passing by did no more than cast puzzled glances in Almama's direction as she stood there looking up at the sky. They hurried toward the subway station as if they had absolutely no interest in either the sky or the moon. As she gazed upward, Almama began to feel the same physical lassitude she had experienced the day before. I have to stop staring at the moons like this, she told herself. It can't have a good effect on me. But try as she might not to look at the moons, she could not help feeling their gaze against her skin. Even if I don't look at them, they're looking at me. They know what I'm about to do. Using ornate cups from a bygone era, the Dowager and Almama drank thick, hot coffee. The Dowager dribbled in a little milk at the edge of her cup and drank the coffee without stirring it. She used no sugar. Almama drank hers black, as usual. Tamaru served them the sandwiches he had promised. He had cut them into bite-sized pieces. Almama ate several. They were simple cucumber and cheese sandwiches on brown bread, but were subtly flavored. Tamaru had a fine touch in making such simple dishes, wielding a kitchen knife with skill, cutting each of his ingredients to the perfect size and thickness. He knew the proper order with which to undertake each task. This was all it took to make an amazing difference in how things tasted.
Have you finished organizing your things?
The Dowager asked. I donated my extra clothing and books to charity. I've packed a bag with everything I'll need in my new life, ready to go at any time. The only things left in my apartment are the basics I'll need for the time being. Electrical appliances, cookware, bed and bedding, a few dishes.
We'll take care of anything that's left. And you don't have to think about your lease or other such details. You can just walk out with the few things you really need in your luggage.
Should I let them know at work? It could raise suspicions if I suddenly disappeared one day.
The Dowager quietly returned her coffee cup to the table. You don't have to think about that either.
Almama responded with a nod. She ate another sandwich and took a sip of coffee.
By the way, do you have money in the bank?
The Dowager asked.
I have 600,000 yen in a regular savings account and 2 million yen in a CD.
The Dowager did some calculations.
There's no problem with your withdrawing up to 400,000 yen from the savings account, if you do it in stages. But don't touch the CD. It wouldn't be a good idea for you to cancel it all of a sudden. They might be watching your personal affairs.
We can't be too careful. I'll cover the difference later. Do you have any other property or assets?
There's the money you paid me before. It's just sitting in a safe deposit box.
Take the cash out.